Speak today. As Jay mentioned, I'm an assistant professor at Columbia, so I'm on the Morningside campus. I'm in the Department of Chemical Engineering, and my research group does work on atmospheric chemistry, and in particular, we study the effects of atmospheric particles on atmospheric chemistry and climate, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that today. So I'll start out by introducing the idea of atmospheric particles, how they impact our lives, and then move on to some general discussion about climate, and then back to how particles play a role in the climate system as a whole. And I'd like to encourage any of you to interrupt me with questions at any time. I know I speak kind of fast, and I want you to get the most out of this possible, so please feel free to speak up if you have any questions at all. So I always like to start with this slide here. This is an image from a NASA satellite of the Eastern Seaboard. They added in the political boundaries here, so you can see this is Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, and then we're up here, Manhattan. And I like this image because it reinforces one of the points, really the main point that I try to make with this talk, which is that when we think about the air and the atmosphere, you know, immediately we think of gases. We think of nitrogen, oxygen, maybe our list stops there, maybe it keeps going. But in reality, the atmosphere also has solids and liquids and other condensed phase material that play a big role in atmospheric chemistry and climate. And so you can see from this image the bright white spots. Of course, those are clouds, right? We're kind of used to looking at pictures like these. And clouds are either going to be liquid water or ice. And they look bright because they reflect the sun's light back to the satellite pretty efficiently. But then in this image, you know, it's not out of focus. This hazy look really is due to haze. This is a summertime image. I think this was June of 2006, a day similar to today. And the image looks a little bit smeared out because of a different class of particles called atmospheric aerosols, which are a lot smaller than cloud particles, and they both scatter light and absorb light, creating this kind of darker, smoky look. You know, we can see it from the satellite image. We can see it when we try to look at the Empire State Building from uptown, something like that. And I'll talk a lot more about those particles today. So, like I said, when we think about the atmosphere, you know, even, you know, I teach college and graduate student level chemical engineering classes, and when we say we have air in our system, usually we're talking about nitrogen and oxygen. I actually have to tell my students that air is 79% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, but that's not exactly true, right? So, you know, we hear in the news all the time, CO2 causes some interesting effects in climate. Ozone is an important component of both the stratospheric ozone layer and then also urban smog. And, you know, so how do we reconcile these two pictures? The truth is that they're both right. So if we look at this pie chart, this shows how much each of these species make up, I guess, by volume or by mole, the gas phase composition in the atmosphere. And in reality, it really is mostly nitrogen and oxygen. I mean, this is to scale. The next biggest slice of the pie, believe it or not, is argon. Who knew, right? but then all of the so-called interesting gases in terms of the phenomena that they cause, in terms of air quality, climate, et cetera, they're there, but in very much smaller quantities, okay? They fit into just this line right here on the pie chart. So just because there isn't a lot of them doesn't mean they're not important, that's for sure. Now, what about everything in the atmosphere that's not a gas? So all the condensed phase material. As I mentioned, we've got the clouds and fog. These species are mostly going to be made of water. It can be liquid water or ice. You know, cirrus clouds are ice particles. If we're talking about the size scale for a cloud droplet, it's going to be anywhere from around 5 micrometers up to 50 micrometers. To give you a sense of what that means, it's a millionth of a meter, or about 1/100th of the thickness of a human hair for 1 micrometer. I think 1 micrometer, I think, is the limit for which we can see with our eye. Okay, so you could see a big cloud droplet if it was in front of you. Now, this other class of particles, which we call atmospheric aerosols, it goes down much smaller in size. So you can go all the way down to 2 nanometers. That would be like a very freshly formed particle, just a few molecules sticking together, up to maybe 20 microns in size. So these include nanoparticles, and we'll be learning a lot more about these today. So they come from a huge variety of sources, and therefore their chemical composition is highly varied. They can be mostly inorganic, like a dust particle, or purely organic or some combination between. If I say particle, usually you think of like a hard dust particle, you think of something solid. But really, this could just be a very small liquid droplet or have a very complex phase morphology like these particles which are shown here. So these are images of particles which were collected in marine regions all over the world. And you can see that these things have really complex morphology. They have some solid part surrounded by a gel. It almost looks like a cell or something like that. All right, so understanding particle chemical composition, also its morphology, these are all things that scientists are interested in, and not a lot is known about them, you know, in general sense. Now, another very important thing to understand about atmospheric particles is that, you know, they're not just existing, you know, if I'm down on Broadway standing behind a bus and I see the gray plume coming out, right? Of course, that is a source of particles in the atmosphere, but even right here in this room where, you know, we have filters and whatever, we have at least maybe 3,000 particles per cubic centimeter in this air that we're breathing. It's coming in and out of our lungs constantly, all right? So outside on a day when it's more polluted, you'll have closer to 10,000 particles per cubic centimeter, but really they're everywhere and they're always affecting us, okay? And another thing to understand is that, you know, we think of, okay, if I put a solid ball into the atmosphere, it's probably going to fall down, right? But actually, when you get down to really small size ranges like this, the particles get lofted up and can get carried along with the air. So actually, what determines the length of time that a particle stays in the atmosphere is how long it takes for it to get processed into a cloud and rain out, rather than gravity or falling out, something like that. Okay, so they can hang out in the atmosphere after they're emitted for around a week. And then finally, I just wanted to say, you know, normally when you hear the word aerosol, you're thinking of like a paint spray, some hairspray, some kind of product that gets distributed through a spray. And it's just because that's a general definition of an aerosol, is some kind of suspension of condensed phase particles in a gas. That's what you're making when you spray your spray can. This is also what we're talking about in the atmosphere. So, all right. So, why do we want to keep an eye on these little particles in the atmosphere? You know, maybe we haven't heard much about them before, but in reality, they're affecting our lives and the environment that we live in a number of different ways, okay? So the most immediate and direct impact they have on us is health effects, okay? So if we breathe in particles into our lungs, people with asthma can have this be particularly aggravated by atmospheric particles. I have asthma. If I look out my window and I can see it's a hazy day, I know I have to take my inhaler with me because, you know, in the summer in New York, I don't breathe that well. In children who grow up breathing high quantities of aerosols, they're more likely to have asthma. There was a recent study that they actually have lower IQ at an older age by the time that they've grown up this way. And and of course, there's also, you know, sometimes these particles will have a toxic material on them, okay? And so just like if you're breathing secondhand smoke or something, there's carcinogens in the smoke. Same idea, some of the particles that are emitted, let's say there's heavy metals emitted in the subway, getting these into your lungs, they can cross into your bloodstream and wreak all kinds of havoc. So they can have potentially serious health effects. Another way in which they directly affect us is by changing visibility. So as I mentioned, you know, you can just see it on a daily basis in the city. Hazy day has a hazy look to it. This is an image I think this is Houston. So a hazy day versus a clear day. You know, visibility is an interesting idea. I mean, it's important to us for aviation, things like that. I mean, it's just ugly to look at. But actually, think about a place like a national park. So, you know, as a nation, we value visibility in those regions so much that it's actually written into the EPA Clean Air Act that we need to protect visibility in these designated areas, okay? So this is another obvious effect of aerosols. But then two more effects which are slightly less direct but very important for the environment are the roles that aerosols can play in atmospheric chemistry. So this area is actually where my group does most of our work, a little bit in here and here. you know, if I say atmospheric chemistry to you, Probably you're thinking about gases reacting together. Maybe there's some sunlight catalyzing the reaction process. But in reality, all that condensed phase material in the atmosphere also participates in atmospheric chemistry. Okay, atmospheric particles can act like little catalysts for certain gas phase reactions, or they can just be separate reactants in this process. And actually, in terms of our understanding of atmospheric chemistry, this is probably the biggest source of uncertainty right now. So a lot of research is being done in this area. How do the gases and the particles interact with each other? And then what's going to be the focus of the rest of my talk after I get through this introduction to particles is how atmospheric particles impact climate. And it turns out that, you know, there's tens of ways in which this happens. Some of them are cooling effects, some are warming effects, and it's one of the biggest sources of uncertainty in our understanding of climate as well. So it's interesting to talk about. Okay, this is an image that David pulled up for me from another one of the satellite databases. This is India and Bangladesh. Yeah, so it's interesting. You can see, just like in our eastern seaboard image, we've got the bright white spots, which are clouds. In this case, some of the white is snow. These are the Himalayas, right? Okay, but the main thing that we see is this nasty river of haze, basically coming from this industrial region in northern India, coming out over West Bengal and Bangladesh. And a few years ago, there was a paper that came out showing a correlation between the yields of rice harvests in Bangladesh and the thickness of this pollution coming out. You know, that's not all due to the atmospheric particles. Some of it is ozone and the gases. But the cumulative effect of this is, I mean, it could be contributing to the rice famine right now. So it's a problem here, problem there. It's an international and global problem. All right. So where do all these particles come from? As I mentioned before, you know, there's the obvious case of you're driving down the road and you can see particles coming out of a vehicle. Obviously, that must be a source of particles, right? That is a big source of particles, or, you know, a plant like this one in Brazil. There's some haze directly coming out of these smokestacks here. Another type of primary emission might be something that's mechanically generated in nature. So you have a dust storm, throws up a bunch of particles into the atmosphere. Or waves breaking in the ocean creates a lot of small particles. If you notice when you go to the beach, your sunglasses get all grimy. That's just from the sea salt particles in the atmosphere. There's a whole other class which probably is more numerous than the primarily directed, primarily emitted particles, which is secondary particles. When I say secondary, I mean you don't start out by emitting a particle. Maybe two gases have been emitted by either a man-made or natural source, but then they undergo a chemical reaction in the atmosphere to make a species which doesn't want to be in the gas phase anymore. Okay, it has a low vapor pressure, and so therefore it either wants to form a new particle, it wants to be in the condensed phase, or it will condense onto an existing particle. All right? So maybe this is like an oxygenation process of organic molecule, or two molecules combining to make a bigger one, so lower vapor pressure. All right. And these generally make up the smallest size fraction because this nucleation process of a few new particle components getting together makes the few nanometer size particles, which I mentioned before. And so thinking about these formation processes leads us to a lot of interesting questions, right? So if I want to regulate the amount of particles which are in New York City, which of course I do. We're always out of regulation in terms of the EPA limits for how much particulate matter we're supposed to have here. Okay, my knee-jerk reaction might be to say, okay, shut down the power plants that are within the city limits, don't drive your cars anymore. Okay, great, we've taken care of the particles. But actually, if we were to do that in New York, it probably wouldn't solve the problem, all right? Because we have a lot of these secondary particles as well. And some of them are not even all due to, we call them anthropogenic effects. So human activity is causing the particles to be made. So let's say upstate we've got a lot of forests, or in Pennsylvania, just westward where the air is going to be coming from. And the forests are continuously generating these natural organic compounds, calling them terpenes or sesquiterpenes. And these things get blown into the city. where they react with the local urban smog that we have here. So basically gas phase chemicals, ozone, OH, NO2, which come from our activities. But it's not a particle yet. But when these things react together with our man-made gases, they make a particle. Okay, can we control this stuff coming into the city? No. We can control the ozone levels in the city, but you have to know some atmospheric chemistry before you know that to control the particle levels in the city, you have to control the ozone levels, right? So it's very interesting to think about these local versus regional sources of air pollution. Here's a case of a dust storm in China blowing dust into Korea. Okay, so Korea gets all of China's stuff, whether it's a natural dust storm or just regular pollution. And they have actually international treaties in Asia towards air pollution crossing boundaries, which in the US we're going to have to start dealing with that soon as well. So background, ozone levels in California are affected by pollution coming from Asia. Europe's ozone levels are affected by pollution coming from us. You know, hopefully we'll be able to start making some treaties to deal with these things in the future. One more thing I just wanted to mention is the idea of, you know, can we necessarily take one particle in the air and say this was a man-made particle or this was a natural particle? Kind of. But let's say we're talking again about this dust storm. It's a natural occurrence, but can some human activities affect the frequency of dust storms? Definitely, right? So how we change the land use patterns and also climate change can cause more dust storms to happen. Same as forest fires, right? So some of these type of fires are actually lit for agricultural purposes, and so those are certainly man-made. But you know, human activities can kind of make the scenario ripe for a regular forest fire to happen as well. So these are just some interesting philosophical questions. All right. So to give you an idea of what someone like me does, you know, how does an atmospheric chemist play into all this? Let's say our overall goal is to improve air quality. And so air quality is a very general term, but more or less we say it's how healthy is the air for you. Okay? So if we want to improve air quality, let's say we want to reduce negative health effects. We also want to address these other concerns. So visibility, increased UV, like that's what happens with the ozone hole, or global warming. What can we do? All right, so I'm an engineer. I like to be able to adjust knobs and see the response of the system to my changes. What can I actually change? Not all that much, actually. We can only change human activities. All right, we can change our emissions, or we can change our land use patterns, etc. And you know, I hope you've gotten the sense already that this only provides a very indirect control over air quality in any particular place. So like my example of the particulates in New York City, all right? And so atmospheric chemists try to figure out this network of chemical processes and physical processes that connect human activities to the air quality that we perceive. All right, and so this is a very incomplete system right now, and we're always trying to fill in the gaps. Yes?
Why are you saying that it's indirect? I mean, if we control pollution by stopping the use of diesel engines through Manhattan, that would, to me, be a direct control.
Well, the example I gave earlier was that sometimes you might have gases which are produced by humans interacting with gases which are produced by plants, right? And if you don't know about that chemistry that happens, you have no control over the particles, right? But atmospheric chemists are right now discovering the details of that chemistry. I mean, this is like a very new field.
Both direct and indirect.
Yes.
You can control it directly, but you just don't know some of the effects that might occur afterward with whatever particles remain.
It's complicated. That's the idea. So you have to know both. You have to both have a sense of where your direct emissions are coming from, and then also the processes that make it indirect. Okay? All right, so in a very graphical sense, we've got our human activities into my engineering machine, which is the atmosphere. Okay, climate is feeding back into that, and then the output of this network of processes is going to be our air quality. Okay? You all have heard about air quality before, right? And the air quality index? Okay. So I'll show you a link in a moment for, my group has designed a website where you can get local air quality information by clicking on a map. It's kind of, we've designed it to be used by students, and so hopefully you guys will be able to get some use out of that, but I'll show that at the end. Okay, so now on to climate. What does climate have to do with all of this? All right, so I just want to mention at the beginning, some of these materials I've borrowed from Daniel Jacob. He's a professor at Harvard, and he's one of the leaders in our field. And he's written a great book on atmospheric chemistry, in case you want to look at his website. So if I'm talking, the easiest way to understand the climate system is to think about the energy balance on the Earth. Okay, so we have energy inputs to the Earth, which is just solar radiation. Okay, and energy output. So this radiation can be reflected back into space. So you can imagine those bright white clouds are reflecting solar radiation back into space, or snow on the Earth. Or once the radiation is absorbed by the Earth, it can also be radiated back out at a longer wavelength, like through black body radiation. All right, so we've got four main processes here. So we've got solar radiation coming in, some of it being reflected straight back out, some of it's being absorbed and then emitted. And in order to be emitted into the into space, it has to pass through the atmosphere first. So the atmosphere is this blanket around the Earth, and this is where the greenhouse gases come into play. All right, so this atmospheric emission factor F is the efficiency by which energy can escape the Earth back into space. And if we have more greenhouse gases, then it'll tend to trap the energy into the Earth system, okay?
And what is the factor 4?
Factor 4.
FS divided by 4, whatever.
This one.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it has to do with the fact that Earth is a sphere, but I'll have to look that up and get back to you, okay? Like I said, I borrowed this slide from Daniel Jacob. So this factor 4 is the black body radiation.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So for, you know, however many millennia before we started to perturb the Earth system, the Earth was in radiative equilibrium, so the amount of energy in equaled the amount of energy out. And that's what we like, because that means that the energy isn't being stored somehow on Earth. Okay? But if we increase the efficiency of this blanket of greenhouse gases in terms of keeping the heat in, the flux out will decrease, and therefore we have some warming on Earth. Okay? Because the way the energy gets stored is in terms of temperature. If we increase solar reflection, or somehow magically decrease the greenhouse efficiency here, we'll have a net cooling effect on the Earth. All right? And basically, by figuring out the balance of these processes, we can directly connect that to what the temperature should be on Earth. All right, and that's what climate models do, is they just do an energy balance on Earth with all these different, what we call forcings, and try to predict what the response of the climate system should be. Okay, so I'm taking a very basic skeptic's view. I'm not a skeptic, but you know, the simplest view possible in terms of, you know, the questions I get from, let's say, the parents of my students who come in and they say, oh, are greenhouse gases really building up in the atmosphere? Okay, the answer is absolutely yes. This image is for just the concentration of CO2 or nitrogen dioxide, N2O, as a function of year. So you can see before the Industrial Revolution, this is around 1800. The levels were pretty much constant, and then after the Industrial Revolution, they shot up. Okay, methane's on this axis.
Question, how
yes.
Did they determine the concentration of those gases prior to the Industrial Revolution?
Usually, these numbers are obtained from records from ice cores. Yeah, so you can go into places like Greenland, where there's always snow. Every year, there's snow coming down, and you can drill in, I don't know, 100 meters deep, something like that. If you slice up the ice core and then analyze the chemical composition in each little slice, there's algorithms that tell you how old each slice corresponds to. So this, you know, this ice is from year 300 or whatever, and then you can get traces like this. So either in the case of methane and carbon dioxide, I believe, or at least in the case of methane, I believe they're looking at bubbles that are trapped in the ice core. But some chemicals are actually processed by snow, and so it's actually dissolved in the snow. And that's an actually really interesting field. And part of our research is related to that. All right. So we're building up greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Okay, this is the most popular question I get. Is there really global warming going on? Okay, there's lots of different ways to measure this. This is from the IPCC 2001 data. So have you heard of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? Okay, this is the number one resource, I would say, for any educator trying to really understand the bottom line of what's going on with climate change. I'll show their URL in a moment. You can download any of their reports. Their most recent report came out in 2007, but even back in 2001, we had this data showing that, okay, certainly within the last 100 years or so, the northern hemisphere temperatures seem to be crawling up. All right, if we're looking since 1850, global average temperature is climbing up. Global average sea level is climbing up, which corresponds to melting snow and ice, right? And snow cover in the northern hemisphere, it's a little bit scattered, but does seem to be going down. All right. Sorry, it's sideways, but here's the website for the IPCC. It's a Swiss website, so it's .ch. Okay. Arctic sea ice is something that's interesting to talk about. These are the things that we hear in the news a lot, another chunk of the Antarctic ice sheet has broken off. Arctic sea ice is having the most dramatic changes. This is from back in 2007. What this shows is if you put together all of the most, state-of-the-art climate models that we've got, the ones which are considered the best science possible by the IPCC, you can run all kinds of scenarios, but in general, the red line here shows what's predicted by the climate models. And then we've got the black line, which shows what's actually been observed by the satellites. All right, so it's bad enough to see this red line predicting that we're going to lose an awful lot of sea ice. So look, this is a 75% change, minus 75% change right here. Okay, but then in reality, it's much worse than they even predicted. Okay, and this doesn't show 2008. 2008 was a disaster year. It was really, really extreme. And so definitely we're losing Arctic sea ice. You hear about, being able to cross the Northwest Passage now, whereas you couldn't anymore. All right. So going back to the idea of the energy balance on Earth, I think I've convinced you that there is some kind of climate change happening. Now, what are the different forces that are pushing on the energy balance in positive or negative way? This slide summarizes, so if we call this a radiative forcing. So if the bar is going to the right, that means it's a warming effect. If it's going to the left, that means it's a cooling effect. And we've got these kind of separated out into just different categories of forces. And then we've got error bars, actually, which tell us how certain we are that this is the right forcing. And also in this last category, which I want you to check out, is the IPCC's assessment of our scientific understanding. So this is the scientists, the best scientists in climate in the world getting together and saying, how much do we really understand about this? And you can see that they're not saying, we know 100% what's going on with all these things. With CO2, they think they have a great understanding of the forcing that it has. It has a very strong positive climate forcing. Here are the other greenhouse gases, methane, N2O, halocarbons. Ozone, okay, ozone down at this level is a greenhouse gas. You don't hear about that much. Water vapor, which I find very interesting, is a greenhouse gas pushing in this direction. The reason why I find this interesting is everybody's talking about how we should switch to a hydrogen economy, okay? And when you combust hydrogen, you get water, right? So are we thinking that this is a good idea to just exchange putting CO2 into the air for putting another greenhouse gas? I don't know. I mean, it's definitely an open question that people are doing research on right now. All right, and now we're kind of moving out of the gases as we go down this chart into so in this case, we've got the surface albedo. Albedo means reflectance. This means, you know, do I have snow on the Earth's surface that's reflecting a lot of energy back into space, or do I have soot covering that snow, and therefore it's absorbing light? You know, black absorbs light, white reflects it. You can see we're kind of torn in terms of what the net effect of changes in surface albedo are on the on climate. But now this is what we've been talking about here with atmospheric particles, okay? I'm going to talk about what these effects are, the direct effect and the cloud albedo effect. But let's just generally note that, okay, it seems that the scientists believe that aerosols probably have a net cooling effect on climate, okay? So these things are going off to the left in this diagram. But check out those error bars. It's pretty amazing, right? And then our admitted level of scientific understanding is very low on these things, okay? So this is an extremely active area of research. And you know, we're trying to improve our understanding of these processes. But let's talk a little bit about the science behind them now. Okay. So if I talk about the aerosol direct effect, what I mean is, how do aerosols directly interact with radiation? So is it going to scatter the light away from Earth, or is it going to absorb the radiation and cause a warming effect? All right, aerosols do both. Okay, so we have aerosols which are primarily made of just, let's say, sea salt and water, and they will scatter radiation. Okay, they increase the Earth's reflectivity and have a cooling effect. They also have the effect of reducing the amount of light that makes it down to our level, so they call this global dimming. And your average haze particle is mostly a scatterer, okay? It does a little bit of absorbing, that's why it looks a little brown, but it's mostly a scatterer. However, then if we think about soot particles, right, these guys are black, and they're going to absorb a lot of radiation, and therefore they have a positive climate forcing. And dust also falls into the category of particles which absorb radiation. And so do some of these haze-type particles, which is definitely an active area of research in my lab right now. Is we're finding that there's some chemistry that can happen in a particle that causes the particle's color to change from being clear to being dark brown, and therefore it becomes an absorber in situ, so in the atmosphere. Yes?
So are the greenhouse gases in the bottom category where they're absorbing the heat?
Not exactly. So the greenhouse gases more play a role when it comes time for the energy to escape from Earth, rather than when the energy comes right in. So this is more like when the energy comes in. It has to do with the wavelength that we're talking about mostly. So it's more like infrared that you're talking about for the greenhouse gases. All right, so the direct effects of aerosols, you know, it's confusing. They can do both. They can have cooling or warming effects. Here's an example of scattering or absorbing aerosols. So dust, as I said, that's a absorbing aerosol. You can see it's kind of yellowish in the image here. This is off of West Africa. Dust storms in Africa actually cause elevated particulate matter levels here, okay? And here's just an image of haze coming from the East Coast. It's more like a bluish color. These are mostly scatterers. Okay, now let's talk about the indirect effect. So whenever I say the aerosol indirect effect, what that means is aerosols impact the properties of clouds a lot, okay? So one of the primary ways in which they do is by acting as nuclei for clouds to form around, okay? So we all know that clouds form when water vapor condenses in the atmosphere, but it's pretty rare that this condensation process will happen without a nucleus for it to happen around, okay? And atmospheric particles are those nuclei. This image shows a fire down on the Earth's surface. Smoke is rising up and up, and then it's basically causing this big billowing cloud to form. So this is a very obvious example of aerosols nucleating a cloud. Okay, here's another example. We've got a city with a bunch of smog. This smog is serving to nucleate this big billowing cloud. Let's see. Ship tracks are another good example of that, right? Or plane contrails as well. So if you've got ships cruising around in the ocean, they leave a plume of pollution behind them, and therefore it's basically becomes a cloud and becomes something very reflective in the ocean. All right. So, aerosol particles act as cloud condensation nuclei. In a scenario where we have more particles versus less particles, we're going to form a higher number of cloud droplets. And since we haven't changed the amount of water vapor that's available, we've therefore made smaller droplets. And therefore, this cloud is more reflective than it would have been otherwise. And there's suppressed precipitation, so the cloud hangs out longer than it would have. Okay? As you can see, I'm kind of simplifying the story. There's at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different indirect effects that aerosols have on the reflectivity of clouds and how many clouds there are. Okay. It's more about the ship tracks. All right. And this is a really interesting example of how we know that aerosols have an important effect on climate. Okay, so if you remember when Mount Pinatubo erupted in 1991, if we look at climate records immediately following that, everything cooled for some time. Okay? And so this has led some people to suggest that, well, if we need to cause some cooling in a hurry, why don't we just emit a whole bunch of particles into the atmosphere? All right? And I have to say that, you know, hopefully I've given you an idea that the atmosphere is a very complex system, all right? So if we put particles in the air, this can affect atmospheric chemistry. It's not necessarily a linear response to how many particles you put in to how much cooling you're going to get. Health effects are there, acid rain, et cetera, especially if you put these up in the stratosphere, the upper part of the atmosphere, which is where volcanic eruptions end up putting SO2 particles. This can wreak havoc on the ozone layer as well, all right? So that's a whole nother talk. But you know, if anybody asks you if you think that what they call geoengineering is a good idea, tell them Professor McNeil said no. All right, so this is our image again. We've got, now that you know what the direct effect and the cloud albedo effect are, so cloud albedo is all the indirect effects. You can see the effects on clouds, not surprisingly, are what we understand the least about, all right? However, we've also got the direct effect. As I said, we've got both warming and cooling direct effects. The thought right now is that probably the cooling wins out, but because we're continuously discovering more and more pathways for making particles absorbing, this might not necessarily be the case. Stay tuned on that. All right. So, an interesting thing about the 2007 IPCC report is that they shifted gears. So if you read the 2001 report, the question was, is there global warming? Like, are humans impacting climate or not? And they said, probably, but we need more data, all right? In 2007, the answer was, absolutely, we are affecting climate, and we need to focus on what we can do about it, all right? And, you know, the answer is not simple at all, right? So what do we do now? I guess long term you can think of doing something to drastically reduce our CO2 emissions and possibly even capture that CO2 that we've already emitted into the atmosphere, right? This isn't going to happen overnight. We're not going to suddenly stop using combustion in our lives, you know, give up electricity, give up our cars, everything. But, you know, that has to be our long-term goal. Near term, we have these ideas of carbon capture and sequestration, and a lot of research is being done at Columbia on that. So the idea that we can capture CO2 as it's coming out of a power plant, or maybe even harvest it from the atmosphere, and then store it in some non-gas phase form. So either maybe injecting it down into the sediment at the bottom of the ocean where it'll change phase, or pumping it into a gas well, et cetera. So people are looking on these more engineering measures. I mean, one problem you can say is like, well, aren't these kind of like band-aid solutions? If we start doing carbon capture now, are people going to just continue with the habits that need to be changed? Yeah, that's true, but you need both, actually. And because it's going to take so long for this paradigm shift to actually happen, you need to have a short-term solution as well. Did you have a question?
There's been a lot of talk about hybrid vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Well, the issue with hybrids, from what I understand, so these are cars with batteries, and so you have to plug them in to the electrical grid somehow, right? And therefore, somewhere there's a power plant doing combustion and making CO2 and worse things to make that electricity. Now, I don't know about the numbers in terms of the efficiency, like maybe the amount of miles per amount of CO2 that you put in the atmosphere is less from the power plant. I'm not sure about that. But no matter what, you're not getting around the problem of putting CO2 in the atmosphere.
What do you do with the batteries, I think,
is yeah, the disposal of the batteries is a major issue as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I read was, and they have to make those special batteries for car, the carbon footprint is larger than the gas that you would save.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Another interesting question is...
That might be propaganda from, you know, car manufacturers.
Yeah.
Want to continue to, you know, have the gas guzzlers are going.
Yeah, but they're all trying to give lip service to the idea of hybrids now as well, even GM, right? So, did you have a question?
What I would like to also add is this idea of the current batteries being less environmentally friendly. Maybe it is for now, but I'm sure it's going to be changing in the future.
Mm-hmm.
With some of the cutting-edge technologies in terms of alternative energy.
Yeah, maybe the batteries will improve, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So in the carbon sequestration, so you're changing the phase of the carbon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're making it into some other form, sticking it underground.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it eventually become part of the carbon cycle again and turn back into atmospheric carbon dioxide eventually?
Yeah, I think over a really long time scale.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we don't know for sure that sequestering carbon in these clathrate forms under the ocean isn't going to cause earthquakes or is not going to somehow come out. You know, we don't know even for sure that it's going to stay there. So, yeah, there's a lot of things to think about with that. Another interesting thing to think about is biofuels, right? So people say, oh, biofuels are, you know, solving CO2 problem. I mean, or even air pollution, you know, just generally we're given the impression that they're very green. Depends on where you do your carbon balance, right? So if you say, if I'm just looking at my car and what comes out of my car, it's pretty much the same. It's not that different from a regular diesel type vehicle. What people like to say though is that, okay, if I draw my carbon balance back around the cornfield or whatever it was that made this biofuel, then okay, the plants have taken up CO2 and therefore I'm somehow balancing out the CO2 that's going to get made. Okay, that's true. But then you also have to include the idea, well, you have to transport the corn to the facility and then how much CO2 gets made in that facility, you know, et cetera. So these are all things that we should think about. And as I mentioned before, we've got geoengineering, which has been proposed as a possible emergency measure, which I don't think is a very good idea. All right. So I still got some time, but I think I'm going to not go into the next part. Okay, if you want me to go. All right, so.
Okay, go into Sims.
Yeah, I'm going to go really fast through this part. So I just wanted to give you a flavor of what we do in my group. Okay? It's not going to be immediately obvious how this connects to climate, but just to give you a sense of what actually happens in my lab. All right, if we're talking about the aerosols in the atmosphere, there are a lot of things that we might want to know about them. Okay, we might want to know how many there are, how big those particles are, especially because the nanoparticles pose a greater health risk. We'll want to know what kind of chemicals are on there so that, you know, we know whether there's particularly toxic chemicals that we're being exposed to. And then I say optical properties. Generally, I'm referring to these climate properties. So is it going to scatter or absorb light? I should have included how does it interact with clouds? Sure.
You said max PM is 49 micrograms. What does EPA recommend? Is it 35?
I don't remember, actually. This was a bad day. This is just a spectrum that I measured outside of my lab on Morningside campus. This shows the number of particles in each size bin versus the size. And this is a very high loading. I mean, this is like what you get in Mexico City. But I don't remember what the EPA recommendation is. It's below that, whatever it is. Okay. So, you know, it's interesting to think about how we even would measure what the composition of the particles are. We've got to probably collect them somehow. You can collect them on a filter and then do various analyses to the particles after you've collected them. However, if you think about a nanometer-sized particle, how much that weighs, it's like barely anything. So basically you're going to be collecting your filter for 48 hours. Then you're going to have 48 hours worth of changes in the atmosphere kind of captured in your filter, and therefore it's going to be kind of a strange signal that you get out. And so there's also ways that you can just sample in the aerosols and then measure their composition as they come in. And one of the techniques that we're using and continuously developing in my lab is called aerosol chemical ionization mass spectrometry. Okay, and this is basically an instrument that my students and I build. So this is my graduate student, Neha. And you sample in gases and particles, and you can detect their composition in real time. So you can get composition information once every tenth of a second. All right. The reason why you might want to be able to sample so fast is, let's say you're going to put your instrument on an airplane, and you want to fly through a ship plume, and the time it takes you to pass through that ship plume is maybe a couple seconds. All right. If it took you 48 hours to get enough sample to be able to actually say anything about the aerosols, then your flight would have taken off and landed by that time. You wouldn't get any information. So it's nice to have a very fast technique. Another example, I mean, so you can use it in an airplane, you can use it in a lab, which is what we do for the most part. Another thing I did, which is kind of interesting, is we put one of these instruments on top of a ski mountain in Oregon. This is Mount Bachelor. And we had it actually in this ice-covered building. We sampled air through that, and it got pulled down into where the instrument was inside. And from this really high altitude on the West Coast, we were able to detect pollution coming from Asia. Okay, it's really cool. All right, it's just some more information about the instrument. And something my students are currently working on, which is making the instrument capable of detecting even lower concentrations of particles in the atmosphere. And this is work that's sponsored by NSF. A lot of our other work is sponsored by NASA, and some of it by private foundations like the American Chemical Society. All right. As I mentioned, primarily we do research which is just based in the laboratory. We're not doing a whole lot of field sampling because, you know, the atmosphere is a very complex system, and if you really want to understand the processes, it's better to intelligently pick an isolated part of that system and understand that first, and then make it more complex as time goes on. I mean, you can also, it's also very important to do field measurements in this research area, as you can imagine. But basically, we've got three communities which are constantly communicating with each other. We've got the lab people like me, we've got the field measurement people, and we've got people who make big atmospheric models, which have weather, climate, and all the atmospheric chemistry mechanisms which we discover in their model, and then we try to find where the discrepancies are and keep advancing the science. Okay, this is just a picture of one of our big reactors. This is just a big Teflon bag, which is about 5 feet on a side. Okay, it's Teflon because you don't want the chemicals to react with the walls. And we have ports where we can put in particles and gases and then detect them with our mass spectrometer on the other side, or particle sizing instruments, or a instrument that can detect how these things can grow up into clouds. And, you know, we'll use a big reactor like this if we need a big residence time, which, you know, of course, in the atmosphere, we're talking about maybe like 12-hour cycles that we're interested in. But we also have smaller reactors for looking at very fast chemical reactions. All right, so this slide I made for you all, which can give some resources. I think I'll make sure that Jay has a copy of the slides for you so you don't have to write all this stuff down. But so there's the IPCC report, which I mentioned. It's a great resource. RealClimate.org is a blog that's put out by researchers at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, which is actually part of Columbia University. And it's here, okay? You might recognize Tom's. This I think this is 113th and Broadway or 112th and Broadway. And NASA's actually there. You'd never know it, would you? Anyway, so we've got a whole NASA lab, which is actually one of the most famous climate labs in the world. We have Jim Hansen, if you've ever heard of him. He's like the most famous climate scientist ever. They all work in this little building here. And some of them operate this... sorry?
No, I'm saying that.
Okay. some of them write this blog. I find it to be a little bit technical. But it's kind of cool, the idea that, you know, these are scientists, you know, arguing with each other about the issues. So, you know, it's interesting to check out. Columbia University's got the Earth Institute, which is kind of a nebulous being, but it's an interesting website. All right. Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure that what you understand is that there's people, and there's labs, there's research, and then there's the Earth Institute, which is like an organization, which is hard to define. another interesting group that we've got is in Earth and Environmental Engineering. It's the Lenfest Center for Sustainable Energy. And these are the folks who are doing most of the carbon sequestration and carbon capture research on campus. It's a very hot area. So this is the NASA website for this NASA lab here. And here's the website for Lamont Doherty. I should have put my website there too, but maybe I'll get Jay to email that to you later. Okay, so this is part of my website. This is not the main thing. But so this is, remember I mentioned to you earlier that we've developed a special outreach website so that people can click on this map, you know, click where you live, and then get direct information about air quality in your area on that day. All right? We've also got a Spanish version of this page. So we think this is kind of cool. We're still developing this particular website. You know, it's not fully all we want it to be just yet, but... we're hoping to make a bunch of information about atmosphere, climate, atmospheric science available for educators and students. So this is just the outreach website. And then my main website is that, if you don't have the science.html on the bottom. Okay. So with that, I'd like to thank the resources that I used for this talk, which is the IPCC and Daniel Jacob. I'd also like to thank everybody in my group, including David, and my sources of funding, which is NASA, NSF, and also the Department of Homeland Security donated some equipment to our laboratory. I'll take any more questions that you have.